reefs and islands of that infinite indented coast, from a lobster boat, maybe, or a windjammer, or a fishing smack. In Maine, it's fun to glimpse the sea from the land, but to survey the dark forests and rocky headlands from the sea, with a fair wind and a running tide, is a glory to last you all your life. What's more, if you're in a boat, you have the ocean pretty much to yourself, and a galley for cooking your chowder, and an anchor for dropping in any of a thousand pretty inlets when night comes on. But if you're in a car, well, the main roads get crowded in August, the lobster pounds have waiting lines, and the bed and breakfast inns fill up with people from away, people like me. On a cloudy Saturday with rain threatening, I headed down east. All visitors to Maine head down east, and all on the same road. The traffic hums along out of Portland on an expansive superhighway, but everybody gets off onto a country stretch of Route 1 at Freeport to stop at L.L. Bean. I did, thinking to buy a fishing cap and some wool socks. That day, the line of traffic stretched 3 miles out from town, inching along toward the L.L. Bean parking lot. I'd have turned around and left, but I was hypnotized by the phenomenon. I can remember when Bean's was a little old frame building with creaking stairs up to the sales floor. Now it's a vast and crowded emporium, selling not only canoes, backpacks, and hunting knives, but also pottery, rugs, and lawn furniture. Bean's used to be the place where you could wander in at midnight and shop for a pair of boots. You still can, but it's better known nowadays as the catalog store that sells $100 million worth of merchandise each year to the Japanese alone. The help is still wonderfully friendly and polite, I'll say that. After an hour or two in traffic and another 20 minutes in the cashier's line, I got my socks and my cap and a tip from the cashier. Don't come on Saturday, and don't come on a cloudy day. Cloudy days, she said, being no good at the beach, are when everybody for 100 miles around decides to go shopping. I fled to my car, which I had parked in the public library parking lot, in spite of stern signs warning me not to, and left Freeport vowing never to return, at least not on a cloudy Saturday. I could have chosen any of 100 other seaside resorts and fishing villages in which to spend my August in Maine, but then Ken Brown would have heard about it and become upset with me. He built his motel in 1967 on the site of the family cannery and lobster business, and I must have stayed there for the first time that summer or the next. He doesn't remember me from those days, but I remember him, the gruff proprietor frowning his way around the premises, tidying up after his guests and his own employees. I've been back to Brown's Wharf often enough to become part of the family almost, and it's a nice family to be part of. Ken and his wife Joan are always there in the lobby or the dining room to greet newcomers. The place has the advantage of being on the wrong side of the harbor. The right side of the harbor is full of restaurants, shops, and people. The streets are one way until after Labor Day, when the villagers get their village back, and there's no place to park over there. If you must go shopping, you can walk from Brown's up to the head of the harbor and cross over on a footbridge. It must be the only harbor-crossing footbridge in Maine. It provides, as Ken Brown tells his guests, a bracing walk. I'm not saying this is the best place to stay in Maine. There may be a lot of better places. I'm just explaining how it happens that I have to stay there. It's all habit and affection and familiarity, and fear of what Ken Brown might say next time I saw him if he heard I'd taken lodgings in some fancy inn in Camden or Kennebunk. There in my room on the water, I'd stir in my bed in the mornings to hear the guttural rumble of the lobster boats leaving the harbor before sunup. That sound was the promise of a fair day, since most of the lobstermen stay in port in a storm. Later, as I was getting dressed, I'd watch the early sunlight whitewashing the houses across the harbor. America's first light falls on Maine each morning, and a clear and lovely light it is. Then, with no plan, I'd go out into the day, on foot down to the docks or by car along the coast, happy just to be there. Each day I'd feel a little more of Maine soaking into my bones. Some days I didn't have to go far, I met Stan Coffin right there on Ken Brown's pier. Stan is a retired lobsterman who learned the skills from his father, William Albert Coffin, well remembered around Booth Bay for his seamanship. While everybody else was converting to powerboats, the elder Coffin went on for a long time lobstering the classical way in a friendship sloop. Stan's father used to sell his lobsters to Ken Brown's father at the Brown Brothers dock, just about where Stan and I were standing. You can't appreciate coastal Maine without understanding the life of the lobsterman. Stan Coffin tried to help me understand. I got up at 5 a.m., he said, and left the harbor before daylight. I used a spotlight to find my buoys. I would stay out all day, get in after dark, work until 11 o'clock at night building and repairing traps, and leave again before the sun came up the next morning. I did that week in and week out and the year around. I was known as a hard worker, Stan said. If you're not willing to work hard, you shouldn't go lobstering in the first place. You lose traps to storms, especially in shallow waters where I always fished, and you lose traps to other lobstermen cutting your lines. You can report that to the warden, but I never bothered with the warden. I just retaliated. If you don't react right away, you'll soon be out of business. A lobsterman might be jealous of you, think you're working too hard. He'll wait for a foggy day and go to rifling your traps. If there's one bit of fog out there, the courts will say you mightn't have seen him and throw it out. I didn't like doing dirty work in the fog, but I learned to do it. I had to protect myself. After a while, I wouldn't lose so many. Then I'd start adding traps. It's still a rough occupation. Many a lobster boat goes out with a shotgun aboard. I told Stan Coffin that I spent a day on a lobster boat in rough weather years ago and was glad when the day was over. You get used to it, he said. There was only once when I stopped fishing before the day was over. That was when my son went overboard. He was 12 or 13 and working as my stern man. We went stern to stern with another boat to pass over a bait box. There came a big sea, and my son tried to hold on to the bait box and went right into the water. He was going down for the third time when I caught him with the gaff. That scared me so bad I went right to shore. It must not have scared his son so much. Now that Stan Coffin has retired, his son has taken up the family occupation. I had seen Stan Jr.'s boat, Bad Penny, in the harbor, and I asked his father about the name. That was his mother's idea, Stan said. A bad penny always returns. Lobsters are expensive in restaurants, but after you find out about the hard work and hazard of bringing them to shore, you never again complain about the price. One of the primal pleasures of Maine is to sit at an outdoor picnic table on a deck over the water with a messy toasted lobster roll dribbling on your fingers, or with a bowl of lobster stew clearing your sinuses, or with the ancient crustacean itself set boiled and steaming before you, ready to be hand-wrestled for its claws and tail. I can't pass a lobster wharf on a sunny day. I have my lobsters plain. I feel that once a human being has outgrown a high chair, he's outgrown a bib, too. Therefore, I eschew the bib and always end up with melted butter on my shirt. One of Ken Brown's waitresses told me that after a few drinks, people are always walking out into the night still wearing their lobster bibs, walking advertisements for the Brown's Wharf restaurant. You cannot escape lobsters in Maine. They are on the roadside signs, on the license plates, on the menus. The McDonald's in Brunswick offers a McLobster sandwich, which I caution against. In Bar Harbor, I saw lobster ice cream, but I can offer no judgment because after giving lobster ice cream a moment of thought, I ordered Swiss chocolate almond. I realize I'm making lobster men sound voluble, which they can be on a subject they know as well as lobsters, but the laconic state of Mainer is no myth. Have you lived here all your life? Not yet. I deserved that one from Brud Pierce. It's a standard Maine reply, which he delivered with a satisfied twinkle in his eye, grateful for being fed the classic straight line. The whole drift of Maine humor, in fact, is toward succinct replies to dense questions from outsiders. How do you get to Bangor from here? Usually my brother-in-law drives me. Or, how many people work here at the cannery? About half. Or, does it matter which road I take from here to Eastport? Doesn't matter to me. Even Ken Brown, a closet sophisticate, likes to play the Yankee bumpkin for strangers. He had a message on his answering machine. Hello, can't come to the phone now, we're all down cellar shucking clams, until his wife made him take it off. One morning I was having my third cup of coffee with Ken and Horace Lee, the retired town banker. Horace, who has a wave and a nod for everybody in town, became a reliable companion on my walks around the harbor. Knowing that I love boats, he took me to see a beauty, an impeccable, locally built wooden yacht named Yorel, back from New York for a visit, and tied up near the tugboat inn on the harbor. We had a word with Yorel's captain, who invited us aboard for a look around, but the deck was so clean I was afraid to walk on it with my dirty shoes. I don't know how many millions Yorel cost her owner. I'd have settled for owning the varnished 12-foot dinghy which rested in blocks on deck, one of the prettiest small boats I've ever seen. How long do you suppose it took to build a boat like that? I wondered aloud. Horace said, let's go ask Sonny. He built it. George Sonny Hodgson is retired, he says. His son Timmy is now president of G.I. Hodgson Company of East Booth Bay. But I noticed Sonny was knee-deep in sawdust, inspecting the keel of a big powerboat when we arrived. Yorel, he said. Oh, yes, Yorel was a job, all right. He searched through some papers in the office and handed me a construction log of Hodgson-built vessels going back to 1818. There I read, 1984, Yorel, 85-foot power yacht under construction. The entry for 1985 was the same, with the notation 6,660 total man-hours. These entries followed. 1986, Yorel, under construction, 36,642 man-hours. 1987, ditto, 55,438 man-hours. 1988, ditto, 74,234 man-hours. Then came 1989, September. Yacht Yorel left for Florida. And that's how long it took to build a wooden boat in Maine. Surpassing craftsmanship, doing it exactly right no matter how long it takes, has always been high on my list of human virtues. I am awed by cathedral stone carvers and master gardeners and weavers of tapestries, and by boat builders who build up an 80-foot hull in eighth-inch increments by hand. If I could have afforded it, I'd have commissioned a wooden boat from the Hodgson Yard right then and there. I went down and looked at Yorel again, and felt sorry for myself for not having such a boat, for not having any boat at all. In Booth Bay Harbor in August, it's easy to get the impression that everybody in the world has a boat but you. As I was wool-gathering in this fashion, mooning about the unfairness of life, I looked up and saw Walter Cronkite's majestic center cockpit sailboat, Winty, entering the harbor. I know that boat at a glance. I've sailed aboard it. If to a boatless soul life in somebody else's harbor runabout seems unfair, a glimpse of Cronkite's shining, state-of-the-art superyacht is quite unbearable. I gave the great man a shout anyway, ran alongside, and pretended to be pleased instead of merely jealous when he invited Ken and me to come aboard and inspect his stately staterooms and his hot-tub-equipped head and his steering station inspired by the cockpit of a Boeing 747. I love and honor Walter Cronkite and his wife Betsy, and it was good to see their daughter and grandson out for a cruise with them. But the life I was pining for that day, voyaging to all the distant ports in a proud and seaworthy craft, is the life Cronkite actually lives. I declined his invitation to sail along to Northeast Harbor, knowing that it was a 90-mile trip and that it would have involved a serious breach of the 10th Commandment. I'd have been coveting all the way. I actually considered driving up to Bass Harbor, walking into Hinckley Yacht Charters, plunking down a few thousand dollars for a week or two in a 42-footer, and setting sail with my crew. But I didn't have a crew. I didn't have a few thousand dollars either. Maybe I thought some other time. I didn't get over my boat dream the whole time I was in Maine. I'm not over it yet. I am drawn to shipyards and anchorages wherever I go. If there's a bit of a breeze, the sound of a halyard slapping a mast arouses a great yearning in me. September, Twin Bridges, Montana. I fell in love with Montana at first sight. I was young and all the world was beautiful to me, but Montana was a great splendor. The steep, snow-clad ranges caught my eye at first, and they are wonderful to see. But over time, my affection came to be for the welcoming valleys. And not for the valleys exactly, but for the rivers that run through the valleys. And not for the fastest or deepest rivers, but for the smaller ones that would support a floating dry fly. But in Montana, though you have come to fish, you walk through fields of flowers to reach the stream and get distracted by the wild roses and showy daisies and blue iris. You learn that only one iris grows in these valleys, and that it grows only where the groundwater is close to the surface. The early stockmen dug watering ponds for their cattle, wherever they found the wild iris blooming. And when you finally get to the river, you see the work of the beavers and share the place with muskrats and with mink. You think you're there to fish, but pretty soon you're there to see the blue heron in the shallows in the morning, and glimpse the gray owl gliding noiselessly overhead at dusk, and hear the coyote in the night. I saw my first ring-necked pheasant flush from the tall grass of Montana, and saw my first trumpeter swans riding the current of the Yellowstone. I had never seen wild horses until I beheld a herd of them, manes flying, galloping through a canyon in the Pryor Mountains. I saw my first antelope-covered hillside in Montana and heard my first elk bugling. I met my first grizzly bear on a trail beside the North Fork of the Flathead River. These were all startling and wonderful experiences, and I can't get them out of my head. Every time I have to leave Montana, in my dreams far away to the east, I see a golden eagle riding the thermals. Hunters and warriors knew this land 10,000 years ago. These mountains looked down upon heroic figures, Sacajawea and Kamiawait, and the great chief Joseph, and Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. And in the parade of white explorers and settlers came some of the most astonishing characters in all the gaudy history of America, like Jim Bridger and John Bozeman and Charlie Russell and Calamity Jane. Among the anonymous trappers and miners, trailblazers, homesteaders, school marms, cattle rustlers, claim jumpers, dance hall queens, and flim-flam men. These mountains have seen much bravery, much generosity, much cruelty and cowardice and greed, much humanity, in short. Some of the stories are almost superhuman. Hugh Glass, the mountain man, was skinned and crippled by a grizzly bear. After days of carrying him on a litter, his companions gave up on him, took his bedroll, knife, and gun, and left him to die in a patch of gooseberries. He couldn't walk or speak. The bear had broken his legs and torn up his throat. But he could reach the berries. Day after day, that sour fruit kept him alive. After a few weeks, he was able to crawl. He crawled and limped 200 miles to a trading post, and eventually got well enough to go looking for his knife and gun. I never see a clump of gooseberries without thinking of Hugh Glass. Even more harrowing was the adventure of Glass's friend John Coulter, taken with another trapper by a Blackfoot war party on the Jefferson River. Coulter's partner was killed and dismembered on the spot. With Coulter, the Indians thought they'd have a little sport. He was stripped naked and told to run for his life. This he did, in an astounding foot race across the rocky bottom land with the Indians pursuing, until flecks of blood started flying from his nostrils. He ran all the way to the Madison River, where he dived underwater and hid until dark in a beaver house. During the next 2 weeks, still naked, he crossed the snow-covered Absaroka Mountains to the Yellowstone River and traveled down the river to Manuel Lisa's fort on the Missouri. He knew nearly every man there. At first, not one of them recognized the naked, bloody, frozen scarecrow who showed up at the gate. John Coulter lived on to describe the geysers of the West to the good citizens of St. Louis, who ridiculed him for trying to peddle such a fantasy as truth. Coulter's Hell, they called it. We call it Yellowstone National Park. September is the perfect time to be in Montana. The sun is slipping away to the south, lengthening the shadows of the haystacks in the fields. The green land is turning golden. Migrating birds are on the wing. The big brown trout are swimming up into the little side streams to spawn. It's time for the county fairs and the rodeos. It's time to start getting the firewood in. Twin Bridges is not glamorous Montana, where the celebrities are buying up big ranches. That's off to the east. That's Bozeman and Livingston and the Paradise Valley, upriver on the Yellowstone. In Montana, upriver almost always means down south. Or away up near the Canadian border around Kalispell and Flathead Lake. This is working Montana, and there was a working man I wanted to spend some time with. Delmer Rowe is a cowboy of the old school, quiet and self-assured. He knows the name and habits of everything that grows or creeps or walks or flies around here. From constant practice, his muscles remember the best way to do everything. Walk a horse, mend a gate, brand a calf. So he does it all with economical grace, no wasted motion. His speech is the same, no extra words. We have been friends for many years, and all that time Delmer would do anything for me, except talk to me for very long at a time. He's a doer, not a talker. He and his wife Beverly are the only full-time employees of a good-sized ranch in the Big Hole River Valley, up the river from a log cabin where I try to hide out in September to go fishing. I knew I could find out from them a lot more than I already knew about cowboying and ranch life, if only I could get Delmer to say more than one sentence at a time. This September, as it happened, the hay crop was sparse after a dry summer, and Delmer finished the haying early. So for a couple of late afternoons there, he and Beverly had time to sit on my porch with me and talk. This is the last romantic figure of American history talking. The cowboy, the real thing. I moved to Montana from Blackfoot, Idaho in 1941, Delmer said, when I was 5 years old. My dad leased a ranch on the Blacktail Creek out of Dillon, and that was when I started riding horses. After school, I worked for a contractor in Dillon 1 year, but I didn't like it. So I got a job on a ranch in the Horse Prairie. I went into the Army for 2 years and came out, and Bev and me got married. We got married in 59, and we spent that summer in a cow camp. It was on Thayer Creek in the Big Hole. I was 23 years old, taking care of 2,500 cattle for $150 a month, and we had an $85 car payment. And we couldn't even get the car up to the cow camp. Had to park it and walk in. Right where we parked it, a moose cow was raising her calf there all summer, so we kind of had to watch out when we started walking. And we thought all this was fine. We've worked hard ever since, I guess you'd say. There's no end to irrigating the pastures and fencing the haystacks. But it's outdoors, out of the city, good place to raise kids. Beverly helps me with everything. Most ranch wives work hard. Beverly Rose said some of them do all the work while their husbands sit in the bars. Well, Delmer said with any ranch job, you don't know from one morning to the next whether you'll be working, so we feel real lucky to have been here 25 years. I don't know where the next generation of ranch workers is going to come from, though. Our kids, Delmer and Phyllis, tried working at the ranch, but they saw it was 9 o'clock at night and they were still working, so they found something else to do. Young people are not interested in this kind of work. What I thought was that young people don't know how to do it and haven't the patience to learn. I watched Delmer build a rail fence one time. Years later, the posts are absolutely immovable, and the rails are precisely locked. It is a fence to last 100 years. It is the accomplishment of a man who never says he's proud of his work, but is. I fixed Delmer a cup of black coffee, he rarely takes anything stronger, and asked him what he and Beverly did on vacation. We never take a vacation, he said. We haven't been to a movie in 20 years. We fish a little. We love to fish. And I usually get one deer in the fall, but I haven't even done that for a couple of years now. And Beverly raises her flowers. Delmer stopped right there and got up. He said, thanks for the coffee, Charles. Got a few things to do before dark. And the two of them were gone. If you are looking for the true Montanans, you don't have to look any farther than Beverly and Delmer Rowe. They aren't rich and don't expect to be. They have not lived their lives with an eye toward comfort and a pension at the end. What they have, I would guess, is worth more to them than money in the bank, the beauty of the land and the continuity of the seasons, and the satisfaction that comes from doing a job that fewer and fewer human beings know how to do, and doing it as well as it can be done. Millions of people in this country doing work they hate can envy them. Ranchers, however, are not as independent as they'd like to think they are. They are dependent on government subsidies. The Forest Service grazing permits, which ranchers regard as a birthright, are a plain giveaway. And they are dependent on the water in the rivers, which ought to belong equally to trout and trout fishermen. And they're dependent on city people to provide a market for their beef. But I find myself pulling for the big ranches to survive, subsidies and all. The alternative is too terrible to think about. Subdivisions, timeshares and condos and 20-acre ranchettes spoiling every river valley in the state. That's what will happen if the ranchers give up and the land goes to the highest bidder. I know some good people who are trying to prevent it. Dick Oswald, the fish and wildlife biologist in Dillon, is working to keep the water coming to the ranches while trying to persuade the ranchers to leave enough in drought years for the fish. The ranchers, by way of ancient water rights, hold all the cards. But when Dick Oswald calls a meeting, they come and listen at least. Ranchers reflexively rage against environmentalists, but the best of them are environmentalists, in fact, stewards of the land. You can't run a good ranch any other way. I went to Helena to see Brian Kahn, head of the Montana Nature Conservancy. He's a 47-year-old lawyer and linguist who looks 15 years younger, former documentary filmmaker, former boxing coach, former ranch hand, former politician, and maybe the brightest Montanan. He said, my attitude toward ranchers is first of all to find a way to keep them in business. That preserves the wildlife right there. 80% of Montana's birds, for example, migrate along the rivers. So when you keep the rivers out of the hands of the developers, you're doing more than preserving the landscape. The Nature Conservancy is growing. There are 5,000 members in Montana. May their tribe increase. Montana is an empire, and imperialists from afar have always been after its resources. Right now, a Canadian gold mining company is planning to rip apart a mountain on the border of Yellowstone Park and leave behind a pool of toxic waste that is almost certain to destroy, eventually, the pure trout streams below. That corporation's executives would say, if asked, "What do you want to do, just leave all that gold in the ground?" To which the only sensible answer is, yes. The first gold miners came and went a century ago. Bannack, the first territorial capital, attracted 3,000 of them in a single year. Bannack is still there, with the wind blowing through the houses and sagebrush growing in the streets. It is inhabited by not a single soul. There's nothing to be seen of the gold rush except the old buildings of the ghost towns and a dredged-out moonscape in Alder Gulch. The Copper Kings excavated Butte and left the city with nothing but a gigantic hole in the ground. The timber barons logged the richest forests and pulled out. Now the Californians are buying the most beautiful ranches. Californians is an expletive, the generic swear word for rich outsiders who wear sunglasses and drive Range Rovers and spend their winters someplace else. In the plains of eastern Montana, the big open, it's coal the exploiters are after. Huge machines are stripping it out of the land. Wallace McRae, rancher and the best of the cowboy poets, lives on the rolling plains near the inelegantly named community of Coalstrip. He came out into his yard and gave me a bear hug as if he'd known me all his life. He's a big, broad-shouldered man of about my age, with a handsome mustache and the wrinkled eyes of an outdoorsman. His ranch is the Rocker Six on Rosebud Creek. Wally's grandfather, John B. McRae, came to Montana in 1882 and started ranching here just 10 years after Custer followed the creek to his destruction 50 miles south and west at the Little Bighorn. I asked Wally McRae how it happened that a third-generation rancher became a poet. "I liked poems when I was a kid," he said. "Bruce Kiskadon's poems used to come in the livestock paper. My sister Marjorie would clip some of them with pinking shears to make them look pretty and hang them on the wall with a blue hair ribbon. That's probably how it started. Then somewhere I heard, write about what you know." What I knew was the ranch. His cowboy poems, some of them, are well on their way to becoming classics that will be recited at Western poetry gatherings a century from now. This makes a pretty good argument for writing about what you know. Wally put me in his blue pickup truck and gave me a tour of Coalstrip. He showed me the golf course and the school that's envied across the whole state, a $13 million high school with a theater and a swimming pool. Coalstrip is a company town which benefits hugely from the taxes the Coalstrippers pay. The neat community is dominated by a gigantic power plant. Wally said they built it out here far enough off the interstate so nobody could see the big stacks. They strip the coal, turn it into megawatts here, and pipe the electricity to Southern California. What they don't burn, they ship east. Here's a coal train loading. You can tell from the code on the hoppers where this coal's going, to Wisconsin Power. This all got reopened during the energy crisis in the 70s. The power consortium sold the country a bill of goods. This operation isn't profitable yet. Here's a coal dryer they just built. They're burning natural gas to dry the coal. Can you imagine that? I said the stripped-over land didn't look anywhere near as bad as I'd feared, nor as bad as the strip-mined ridges in the Kentucky coal country. Wally said we fought 'em in Helena and Washington. We wanted this land restored, and they've done a good job of it. But do you think that's because of the natural benevolence and public-spiritedness of the companies? Hell no. It's because when they laughed in our faces, we went to Helena and got a 30% severance tax slapped on 'em. Then they were willing to negotiate. The tax is down to half that, I suppose. So they do restore the land and plant grass, but they've still messed up the water. Wally is obviously proud of Coalstrip. He's given poetry readings in the high school theater and played roles in community plays. But all of Coalstrip is not proud of him. After he helped lead the land reclamation campaign, a woman went into the community bookstore. She said, "I see you have books by Wallace McRae." "Why, yes," the proprietor answered. "Well," the woman said, "I'll never do any business here again," and walked out. I asked Wally why. Oh, he said, she probably thought I was going to lose her husband his job. That's the Montana dilemma right there. How to guarantee the matchless beauty of the place forever, without costing working people their jobs. The stubborn optimists, like Wally McRae, think it can be done. I covered a lot of miles over the next few days, wandering almost aimlessly over the gorgeous contours of Montana. I stopped near Greycliff Creek on a cool morning to visit a prairie dog town. The animals were touching noses, grooming one another, helping out with their neighbor's burrow building, the prairie dog equivalent of the old pioneer barn raisings, and comporting themselves in general very sociably and cooperatively. Prairie dog experts may know of flaws in prairie dog character, but I never have observed any. Because they eat precious grass and dig holes in the range, ranchers have spent a lot of time shooting them or trying to poison them off. But I would say that prairie dogs, by prairie dog nature, behave better than most humans do by human nature. I went to the rodeo parade in Dillon, a very appealing affair, with Boy Scouts carrying the flags, the kids from the high school gymnastics club doing backflips on a moving flatbed truck, spangled cowgirls on horseback, and a column of brand new bright green John Deere tractors, including one with air conditioning, FM radio, and what must have been a $10,000 picture window windshield. What would my grandfather, the North Carolina one who plowed with a mule, have made of that thing? And who in this crowd could afford it? While I was in Dillon, I bought an ice cooler and some picnic supplies, marveling at the size of the weekend crowd in the supermarket. These days, people from even the most remote ranches do their provisioning at the Safeway, like everybody else. Old cowboy verse on the wonders of evaporated milk. No tits to pull, no hay to pitch. Just punch a hole in the son of a bitch. With my food supply on ice in the Jeep, I was free to stay in whatever Ma and Pa Motel presented itself at the end of the day. All this time I was stopping to fish whenever I saw a place to park along a river. Near Chico Hot Springs on the Yellowstone at Emigrant, a young mule deer waded into the water 100 yards away, regarded me with a few waggles of his giant ears, and proceeded to drink as if I weren't there. When I sat down at a picnic table beside a willow thicket to have my lunch, a woman who had come down to the river to exercise her dog walked over to say, "You better watch your back. A mama bear is bringing up her cubs in those bushes. She's run me away from that table twice." I said thanks and forgot about it. A few minutes later, I heard a slight rustle in the willows and a low but unmistakable growl. I decided to find another place to have lunch. I walked up the narrow Boulder River in my hip waders, happening to catch it at a time when an insect hatch was on and the bright circles of rising fish appeared in every pool. I was able to hook a lively small rainbow trout on every third or fourth cast. I put each of them gently back into the stream, having taught them the difference between a bug and a goofus bug. These little trout are highly educable. The lesson I gave them will make it a bit harder for the next fisherman who wades that stretch of river. Fishing has taught me lessons, too. I have learned much about the habits of old, wise trout, and of young, foolish trout, and about the ways of their stream-born prey, mayflies, caddisflies, grasshoppers, ants, and beetles, whose lives are no less interesting for being lived in miniature. What's more, I've learned a thing or two about human behavior on trout streams. I've discovered that patience serves better than haste, that silence is a virtue, and concentration its own reward, and that I, at least, like to fish alone. Trout fishing should not become a contest. I never string up a trout rod without wild anticipation. Often I've been exhausted on trout streams, uncomfortable, wet, cold, briar-scarred, sunburned, mosquito-bitten, but never with a fly rod in my hand have I been unhappy. I can't express the joy I felt in my Montana September, driving slowly along a different river day after day, free of all obligations and open to all possibilities, with my fishing bag in the passenger seat beside me. The most important item in the arsenal is the rod. You can catch fish with a limber stick or a bamboo pole, and once upon a time everybody did. Then rod makers became more sophisticated, making rods out of split cane, before graduating in our time to fiberglass, then graphite, the present fly rod material of choice. A precious few have returned to the subtle craftsmanship of split bamboo. I knew that one of the great bamboo rod makers, Glenn Brackett of the R.L. Winston Rod Company, lives in Twin Bridges. His meticulous split cane rods sell for $1,500 and up, and the world beats a path to his door. On this trip, I worked up the nerve to pay him a visit. I needn't have worried about disturbing the master. He turned out to be a nice guy who doesn't mind talking while he works. The cane is Chinese, he said, from near Canton. The Chinese supply the whole world with Tonkin cane. They used to ship it to us in beautiful rattan wrappings, then in burlap. Now it comes wrapped in plastic. That's the way the world goes, I guess. But the quality of the bamboo is still the same. We store it in a room behind the town library. It ages there for a year or two or longer. Glenn used to be an owner of the Winston Company, which makes fine graphite rods, but he sold his interest in order to concentrate exclusively on bamboo. There's much more art to matching, cutting, tempering, gluing, and finishing the strips of bamboo, and Glenn likes the result better. All Winston bamboo rods have a hollow core, he said. I don't think any other maker will say that. It's a lot more work, but it makes them lighter and gives them better action. It takes most fishermen 10 or 15 years before they're ready for a bamboo rod, before they're ready to fully take part in the sport. I tell fishermen you won't like it at first, you have to keep coming back to it. It's like a relationship with a woman, maybe. After a while, the rod becomes your true companion and friend. It's good to you, even though it knows your weaknesses. Graphite casts a fast line, Glenn said. It takes a good deal of time on the stream to learn the advantage of a slow line. By its nature, bamboo doesn't want to smash the fly down on the water. It wants to float it down gently. The slower line gives you more control, more precision. You want the fly there, it goes there. You learn to trust a fine bamboo rod, and after a while, nothing else feels right. As he talked, Glenn's eyes were busy, concentrating on his work. He clearly wants every bamboo strip to be flawless, every finished rod to be perfect. You have to take the time, Glenn said. If you don't, the work will come back and haunt you. Cane gets better with age. You have to wait. I watched Glenn Brackett work until the end of the day. Before we parted, we sat around a packing crate, had a beer together, shelled some peanuts, and talked about fishing. I kept looking over toward the heated cabinet, where today's Glenn Brackett rods were starting the year they must wait before reaching the hands of fishermen. Someday, I thought. One morning in Montana, I turned 60. I was rolling along on a dirt road beside a river with the sun coming up and a cup of hot town pump coffee in the cup holder, happy as I have ever been, and listening to the radio. Garrison Keillor's Public Radio Almanac show came on, and I heard him say that it was my 60th birthday. I thought, is it? Well, I'll be damned if it isn't. Well, all right then, I'm 60. I thought of my father back home in North Carolina. I'd be going to see him in a few days. He was seriously ill, but still in good spirits, and he was 86 years old. I'd settle for that, I thought. That would give me plenty of time to own a Glenn Brackett bamboo rod and get the feel of it. Good for Pop. 86 would be all right for me, too. 86, if I could make it, would give me 26 more Septembers in Montana. Thank you. October, Woodstock, Vermont. The first week of October in southern Vermont is the unbearably beautiful American time and place. Brilliant yellow birch-covered hills slope down to glowing green meadows. Every sugar maple along every country lane combusts in scarlet and gold. The autumn sun brightens the white church steeples in the pretty valley towns. Plump pumpkins appear in orange pyramids outside the crossroads stores, and the smell of wood smoke hangs in the air. The intensity of the season so overpowers the senses that it cannot be remembered from one year to the next, so its splendor always comes as a shock. When I was planning my perfect year, the one time I knew I mustn't miss was the first week of October in Vermont. But I missed it. My father died in North Carolina in the first week of October. He was an undemonstrative man, but he had bought a card at the drugstore the month before and written me a note. I found it when I got home from Montana. "Charles, the day you were born 60 years ago was the best day of my life." This note was moving, of course, but unlike him, it told me that he must be feeling his glass running out. My sister Catherine and I cared for him, then Catherine alone, then I alone, then my brother Wallace. Our father lay propped up by pillows on his old maroon divan with a comforter across his knees. He said less and less and ate less and less. He stoically took his pills ground up in ice cream until he was not able to do even that or was not interested in bothering. Once I tried to pick him up gently to move him back into a comfortable position, but he had run out of comfortable positions. He gasped in sudden pain and said, "Charlie, I swear I'll kill you." This was the last full sentence my father spoke to me. We buried him beside our mother in the cemetery in the pine trees. I conducted the graveside service myself, not wanting some preacher who didn't even know my father saying platitudes over him. Wallace and Catherine spoke, too. We had a moment of silence, and then everybody walked back to the house for a drink. I liked the people who came to the funeral, besides his friends, who really were friends, and his neighbors from up and down the road. There were the tellers at the bank to whom he brought flowers from his garden two or three times a week, the checkout lady at the grocery store, some of the children for whom he sat out on the porch and carved toys, the waitress he used to kid around with at the cafe on the fishing pier. You could tell they all felt a good man had died. He was a New Englander by birth who always loved the Vermont October. After a few days, I went there for both of us. By the time I got to Woodstock, though, the brilliant part of the fall was over. The days were misty and gray. The last leaves were falling, and I couldn't shake the sadness. The perfect year had turned far less than perfect. For a while there, I didn't know what to do with myself. I fell back on my old habit, going for a drive. The state's dirt roads are lovingly maintained, smooth as pavement, with never a pothole or a washboard furrow, at least in the summer and fall. How do the Vermonters do it when nobody else can? They are rarely clearly marked, if at all, these back roads, but not to use them would be to miss much of the glory of Vermont. On a whim, I took such a road near Vershire, with the hope of sooner or later reaching the village of Stratford. The road took me along a brook, over a steep rise, and past a magnificent Georgian house presiding over a tidy hill farm, which I couldn't have expected was there. I chose from among one-way lanes marked Bliss's Farm Road or Chesterfield Hill Road, and just following my nose happened to make all the right choices. I came out right on the Stratford Town Green. On the hill above that green stands a wooden building I love. It is an emblem of much that is fine about Vermont. Just inside the door there's a sign that says, "The Old White Meeting House, built in 1799, and consecrated as a place of public worship for all denominations, with no preference for one above another." Since 1801, it has also been in continuous use as a town hall. I spent an inspiring day in that building once. It was on the one day in Vermont when the town carpenter lays aside his tools, the town doctor sees no patients, the shopkeeper closes his shop, and mothers tell their children they'll have to warm up their own dinners. It was the day the people of Vermont look not to their own welfare, but to that of their towns. Town meeting day. What happens in the town meeting is not representative democracy. It is pure democracy. Every citizen may have his say on every question. And many voices were heard that day in Stratford. For an hour, for example, they debated the question of whether to go on paying $582 a month for outside health services, deemed unsatisfactory by a farmer named Brown. When the moderator, rail fence maker James Condict, couldn't tell how the voice vote had gone, he said, "I'm going to ask for a standing vote. All those in favor," and here it came, the Yankee expression, which originated in the town meeting and has entered the language of free people. "Stand up and be counted." By a standing vote, Stratford agreed with Farmer Brown and eliminated outside health services from the town budget. This is the way the founders of this country imagined it would be. Citizens meeting in their own communities to decide directly most of the questions affecting their lives and fortunes. This is the way Vermont still does it. And all voters must take an old oath, always to vote their consciences, without fear or favor of any person. On a weekday October afternoon, the old white meeting house was shut and still. But when town meeting day rolls around again, it will be, again, the lively, democratic center of one town's small universe. Woodstock, which I made the center of my October wanderings, is one of America's 10 prettiest villages. The other 9 are also in Vermont, probably. Woodstock's green was laid out in the 1790s, and the handsome federal houses that face it were built about the same time. But in the preservation of the village to the present day can be detected the fine hand of Lawrence S. Rockefeller. I never have met him, not being one who moves in such circles, but I have driven along the Palisades Parkway beside the Hudson River and sailed to St. John and the Virgin Islands, and appreciated the wildlife on the range in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. These, among many other places, were saved by Lawrence Rockefeller. When he looks around, he must be happy with the way he has spent his money. The most imposing house in Woodstock is Lawrence Rockefeller's, the historic Billings Mansion, once home of that Vermont Billings who became a railroad tycoon and left his name on the city I'd just come from in Montana. The house is on the National Register of Historic Places, along with almost all the rest of the village. I made do with an inexpensive old house in the woods, where I could do my thinking and map reading and grieving for Pop. I sat on the wooden steps out there with my morning coffee and watched the chipmunks scurrying through the fallen leaves. There must have been 20 or 30 of them racing around in a hurry to get ready for winter. When I went for my daily drives, I noticed that people everywhere were doing the same, sawing and chopping, making prodigious wood piles in their yards, or driving their pickup trucks to and fro loaded with firewood. I dug down in my bag for a wool shirt and sweater. There was a chill in the air every morning now, noticeable both to chipmunks and human beings. I took a different road each day, usually with no particular destination in mind. In Vermont, it seems to me, one road is pretty nearly as inviting as the next. There are no billboards on any of them. Vermont restricted billboards back in the 30s and banned them altogether 25 years ago. The inns and attractions, the roadside cheese stores and antique shops thus come into view unannounced. Even such a famous institution as the Vermont Country Store in Weston can come as a surprise, noticeable mainly for the cars parked around it. The billboard law, besides preserving the rural views, gives every drive in the country a feeling of serendipity. One Sunday, I went in search of a famous Vermonter, Justin Morgan. Justin Morgan was a farmer and singing master in Randolph, Vermont, who bought a 3-year-old stallion in 1792 and used him as a saddle and harness horse and for work around the farm. The stallion was much admired as the Justin Morgan horse. He was a strong and willing animal with a broad forehead, prominent and kind eyes, an elegant neck, a short back, a long mane and tail, and a friendly disposition. And though he was bred to a wide variety of mares, his offspring had a way of turning out just like him. All of Farmer Morgan's neighbors wanted a Morgan horse to breed for themselves. By the time of the Civil War, the Vermont cavalry rode into battle on 1,000 Morgan horses.